So we're going to open the committee. Welcome to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Technology Management and Technology for February 12th. And we have a pretty full agenda. And we're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 1538. And if you could start us off on that.
Certainly. Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. The first item up is a public hearing on Senate Bill 1538. Senate Bill 1538 relates to information security for the state of Oregon. The bill requires state agencies to notify the Legislative Fiscal Office promptly concerning information security incidents and to provide the Legislative Fiscal Office with copies of and report results of information security assessments. This bill also requires heads of certain state agencies to provide an annual report concerning information security to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. All of the materials related to the bill and the Dash 1 amendment, the staff measure summary, the fiscal impact statement, revenue impact statement are all posted on OLIS. If it pleases the co-chair, I'll go ahead and describe the Dash 1 amendment.
Sure.
The Dash 1 amendment modifies definitions of key terms and clarifies the conditions under which state agencies must provide information security assessment and incident notifications to the Legislative Fiscal Office. The amendment removes the requirement that state agencies provide the Legislative Fiscal Office with copies of and reports and report results of information security assessments. Information security assessment and incident notifications and associated information may instead be shared via a method and at a level of detail to which the state agency and the Legislative Fiscal Office agree. In addition, the amendment removes a provision that would allow the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology to hold executive sessions regarding information security matters under ORS 192.660, as the Oregon Constitution requires all deliberations of the legislature and its committees to be open. Finally, the amendment clarifies that annual report information may not include information security information or other materials that are exempt from disclosure under ORS 192.410 to ORS 192.505. It's important to note that we had a very full and rich discussion with a variety of stakeholders. We worked over several weeks with the Secretary of State, with representatives from the Oregon State Treasury, the Department of Justice, the Oregon Judicial Department, the Legislative Administration Committee, and the Office of the State CIO and the Chief Information Security Officer. The Dash 1 amendment was a product of that collaborative work. To my understanding, the partners support the amendment.
Any questions of staff about this? Do we have anybody signed up for testimony?
We do not.
Is there anybody who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on what is it?
Senate Bill
1538. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1538.
And Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, at this point, then we would need a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1538.
So, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 to 1538.
So, Representative Nathanson moves that we adopt the amendment to 1538. Any discussion? Any objections? It is amended. And the chair would move that 1538, Senate Bill 1538, as amended, be moved to the floor of the, where is it, House or Senate?
It is a Senate bill, and so it would move to the Senate floor first.
Senate floor. Okay. And
Perhaps I can give the recommendation. My apologies. LFO recommends the measure be reported out of the JLCMT with a due pass as amended recommendation.
You want that motion?
Okay.
I moved that, what he said.
All right. Representative Nathanson moves that way the Senate Bill 1538 as amended be moved to the the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Moves to the floor of the Senate.
And at this point, Senator Riley, we do need carriers in both chambers.
And I'll carry it in the Senate. Representative Nathan, or would you like? This is a committee bill. I'll give Representative Nathan some first chance at this. Would you like to carry it?
I think Representative Neerman would like to. Is that correct?
If I could, I would like to.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay, it's assigned to Representative Neerman. Thank you.
Great.
Okay. So we're going to move to a work session of the Office of State CIO DAS IT Procurement Reorganization Request.
Senator Riley, my apologies. In terms of procedure, I'm assuming, did we close the work session on Senate Bill 1538?
We did.
Okay, great. We'll now need to open and close, per the rules that have been adopted, individual work sessions on the remaining items. We are going to change the order a bit of presentation. I've informed the agencies that are with us today about that. We'll start with the Office of the State CIO and the DAS Procurement Services Organization. They'll be here to talk about the IT Procurement Reorganization Request. I do have a brief description of that that I can give to the committee once the work session has been opened.
Actually, I opened the
Great.
Work session. And
thank you.
Go ahead.
So as described in the LFO analysis and recommendation memo posted on OLIS, during the January 2016 legislative days, the Oregon Department of Administrative Services and the Office of the State Chief Information Officer made a multi-part rebalance request and gave a report on the agency's 2015-17 budget bill, Senate Bill 5502, to the General Government Subcommittee of the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The Legislative Fiscal Office provided its general support for most of the requested items, but recommended that the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means defer action on the rebalance request until the proposed changes to state IT procurement and vendor management could be further reviewed by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology during the 2016 session. As I mentioned, we have the DAS State Procurement Services Manager and the State CIO here today to explain the request. And,
so,
if you could wait 1 second, could we get the projection?
Great. So, if you'd state your name for the record and proceed. As soon as we get a screen up. This is the IT committee.
Senator Riley, if I might, all of the information technology staff in the room are very familiar with this experience.
And most of them are the executive branch, and you are trying to do this in the legislative
Absolutely.
Branch. That makes a difference.
Sure.
We are. We're waiting for their presentation to be up on the screen.
You'll have to continue anyway.
If you can, let's just go ahead and
members of the committee, we do have this presentation posted on OLIS. If you've got your laptops up, you certainly can view along. If you could give us an indication of which slide you're on until we can get the projection working, that would be great.
That's fine.
I can see on the House side, we've all got it up in front of us.
Well, very good. Chairman Riley, Chairman Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon. I have with me today Debbie Dennis, who will introduce herself now.
Yes, for the record, I am Debbie Dennis. I am the State Procurement Services Manager with the Department of Administrative Services.
We're here today to talk to you about an element of the rebalance that was brought forward, specifically the DAS procurement IT supply chain management report that we've put together. And so I'm going to move now to the second slide. Talk about some of the challenges in the changing IT landscape. So in the old models, we had existing service models lacking flexibility and failing to meet agency needs. The state can no longer afford to own or maintain the entirety of its IT portfolio. The fragmentation and duplication of services undermines interoperability and results in duplicative investments and increasing sophistication of long-term IT vendor relationships. So as our business transforms, so too does the business of the state. And so how that translates then, it's no longer about procuring single solutions or single types of one-time procurements. It's about having an extended relationship with the vendor and to make sure that as we go forward, the needs of the state continue to be met. It's an operational relationship rather than a capital type one-time procurement or financial exchange. So opportunities are, this will give us scalabilities, low barriers to entry for new service lines, standards and master agreements, enterprise approach, and vendor management. So building capacity to manage our IT vendor community. I'm on the fourth slide now. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Debbie for a minute.
Great. Thank you. So the next few slides are from Gartner. And this slide we're on here, it has a quote from Gartner that underlines the importance of vendor management in the landscape we're dealing with today. For those who don't have the presentation, the quote is that vendor management is increasingly important as a distinct discipline because newer cloud delivery models and niche vendors can generate a lot of value for a business while also introducing a high degree of risk that requires management. So in essence, as we move to this operating environment as opposed to capital investments, our relationships with the vendors become increasingly important. The next slide is the framework of an effective IT vendor management program. The first column is talking about creating and setting up the structure for an IT vendor management structure. This is where we define the metrics, we classify and analyze our current portfolio of vendors. In the next column, here's where we are onboarding and offboarding vendors. We're procuring, we're conducting solicitations, we're negotiating with vendors, and we're onboarding contractors.
Let me stop you for a second. Alex introduced you, but we'd like you to state your name for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Debbie Dennis, State Procurement Services Manager at the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
The third column talks about the work of actually managing the vendor base, managing performance, managing relationships, managing risk. And then in the fourth column, these duties are all about measuring and analyzing the results and communicating and improving our vendor relationships. Moving on to the next slide, it's the same slide as the previous, and we've color-coded it to demonstrate the activities that the state is participating in today and the ones that we are not. You'll see the areas in red, the first column and the final column, are activities that we are not conducting as an enterprise today. The two columns in the middle, the blue and the yellow, are activities that we are conducting today. The blue we are doing on a regular basis. We are selecting vendors, evaluating vendors, negotiating contracts, all of that work. The activities in yellow are activities that we are doing, but we're doing them on an ad hoc and project-by-project basis. So things like managing performance, managing relationships, managing risk, we're certainly doing those things, but it's as it relates to particular projects as opposed to as an enterprise managing those relationships. The next slide talks about the IT procurement workload in the enterprise during the last biennium, 2013-15. You'll see that we had about 11 staff dedicated to IT procurement at DAS. In the first column, those are the IT procurements that were conducted by DAS for DAS. So we did 68 new contracts for DAS, and we did 502 contract actions. Those could be amendments, purchase orders, renewals, all of those things. The next column over is IT price agreements. We have 103 IT price agreements on the books today. Not all of those are available for statewide use at this time, and so that is an area that we are working closely with the Office of the State CIO to ensure that all of the IT price agreements are available for broad use. The third column are the contracts that DAS conducted and the solicitations we conducted on behalf of other agencies. So we executed 32 IT contracts for other agencies and 203 related contract actions. The final column are contract actions that were conducted by other agencies, either under DAS delegated authority or in the case of OHA, they had independent authority at that time. So the smaller number, the 39 and the 72, those were specific delegations that were given from DAS to agencies to conduct those IT procurements. And the final column are DHS, ODOT, and OHA, and those were conducted either under OHA's independent authority or under a tiered delegation that ODOT and DHS currently hold. They currently hold a tiered delegation to conduct procurements up to $5 million.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a previous session, I sponsored a bill, House Bill 2375, that said, look, we need to make this a lot simpler. And it put forward basically a structure and a method of standardizing contracts. The point was to simplify, standardize, and make it a lot easier for Oregon businesses and other businesses to do business with the state. Whenever you talk about procurement, I'm thinking, what did we do to start making it simpler to purchase IT as well as any other kind of product or service? Have we, how many standard type contracts have we been able to put in place so that in different agencies they can get their business done in a more straightforward manner?
Sure. Senator Co-Chair Riley and Co-Chair Nathanson, to address that question, we have currently put in place one IT contract that's been designated for use under the House Bill 2375 umbrella. We have two others that are in the works, and we also have one. We've done the RFP template as well.
Okay. I'll follow up individually later to get more detail, but thank you for that report.
Okay. The next slide talks about our proposed realignment. Under a true vendor management program, we would be expanding our portfolio of IT price agreements that are available, which would in turn drive standardization and interoperability. The plan would be to increase that portfolio to 200 or more price agreements that would be available for statewide use by state government and local entities. That would reduce the number of ad hoc and agency-specific procurements that would be conducted. To do that, we would need to add additional staff. We are proposing that the State Procurement Office add two additional FTE to support the price agreement build out, and two additional FTE to handle the incoming workload with the reduced number of delegated one-off procurement activities. in the Office of the State CIO, we are requesting to add two FTE that would manage the vendor management portfolio program.
So if I might ask, the tiered delegation, you're not proposing to change that at all?
Co-Chair Riley, we are not in this proposal. We have not included any resources to cover the incoming workload from the tiered delegation model. We are in conversation about changing that model, but it would be more along the lines of resource shifting as opposed to additional resources.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right, this is kind of a busy slide, but I wanted to be sure that I articulated what it was that, so remember those two folks back here that are the OSCIO folks, what does that mean? So what we've done in a previous life is we set up what was called a technology reference model. A technology reference model is what is the build, what are the things, what are the components, what are the elements of what the state is putting together, a catalog, if you like, of products and services that are designed to interoperate, are designed to meet the needs of organizations, are things that for particularly smaller organizations, smaller entities, be they municipalities or school districts or small agencies, can buy right off a state contract and not have to go through a great deal of design and concern about interoperability around will this piece work with that piece and what have you. This is a transformative model of how to organize, how to think of IT and IT services and IT products. And so our goal here really is to be able to help structure, it would be voluntary, of course. Nobody's mandated to use statewide contracts. But for agencies, executive branch agencies, this would certainly be the build that we would be moving towards. So they would be required to use that design. For those folks that are outside of the state, the municipalities, the counties, the school districts, other governmental agencies, this would be a proposed design, and they could choose to adopt it or not as they saw fit. And we've had we've dubbed it here Basecamp. In my previous life, we dubbed it Open Range because that just fit more of the the culture of the area that I came from, that I had done this first. And so if you're curious to see it, it's openrange.ok.gov, and that goes through and discusses what it was that was done. We went from we built a technology reference model. We went from 69 contracts that we had statewide contracts to over 300. And those defined or helped define for organizations what it was that would be interoperable, would be supported, and help to give them direction. So we're talking about putting this in. So there's really two work streams or two swim lanes, if you like. The gap analysis with the technology reference model. So of the 103 or so contracts that we have, which ones do we have that already fit into a bucket here and there, and where do we have gaps? We're defining our requirements to those gaps, doing the market research in cooperation with DAS procurement and the strategy development. And then it shifts over to the competitive bidding from DAS procurement, the negotiation and contract development, and then implementation and management comes back to OSCIO. That's really back and forth between the two groups. And again, it's a good practice. A separation, segmentation of duties is a good idea when you're doing procurement type stuff. It just, even if there's nothing going on, it's still good to know that nothing's going on. So
as you can see, we now have the screens available for other people to see.
So, I guess, do you want to summarize it or you want me to summarize it? I can summarize it. The IT landscape has shifted fundamentally with cloud service offerings. The ad hoc and of IT procurement fragmentation of the business of the state creates duplication and really puts us at risk. Successful cloud deployment will require strategic partnerships and vendor management, because it's not just to get something and then one time it. Our capacity and coordination, our new capacity will enable the development of an IT catalog of shared services, leveraging the state's purchasing power for the benefit of state agencies, partner jurisdictions, and school districts. So, if there are any questions, we're happy to try to answer them.
I guess I have a question.
Senator Thatcher.
How does that interface between cities, you know, the entities outside of the state government, is there an infrastructure in which these conversations take place, or is it just kind of a one-off sort of situation between cities that are in the know? And, you know, I'm just wondering, is there anything formal?
Co-Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, thank you for the question. In my previous life, what we did is we did work in cooperation with many of those external entities. If you have a minute for a story here, when we did this before for the school districts, we articulated a student record system for small, medium, and large school districts. And what we had done by doing that is we encourage districts to move to one of these three service providers. One was a cloud provider for small, for medium it was Pearson, and for the large one it was PowerSchool. So we encouraged them to move to that. That allowed us, not only supported the systems, longitudinal data system integration, because we only had three systems to integrate, but in the end, for all the districts, they would report the attendance of all the offices of all the schools in the state by 10 o'clock in the morning every day. When we had the tornado go through Moore, it wiped out the Briar Hill Elementary, Towers Elementary, as well as the Moore Independent School District's data center. And so when folks came to ask to view the bodies in the temporary morgue we had set up, we needed a way to identify or have them identify themselves or tell us who they were looking for. Because the state had this set up, we could give the cut sheets to the Oklahoma Highway Patrol to tell them who was in the buildings, staff, the students, and the administrators that were in those two buildings, at least as of 10 o'clock in the morning. So when the tornado had come through at 2, if folks hadn't shown up or hadn't reported in, we'd associate a person with who they were looking for and then either allow them in or not. And so that was one of those things that was very helpful to us to do. So there's a lot of benefits to doing this type of and moving towards standardization. And you're right, it can only be done through the cooperator or with the cooperation of the folks. But those are there's a lot more to be won here besides just the financial implications of it.
Maybe you could tell us about the Oregon Cooperative Procurement Program. That'd be great.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, I'd be happy to. We currently have a program in DAS Procurement Services where we have intergovernmental agreements with hundreds of local governments and school districts where they currently today access our statewide price agreements. We have a person on staff that's dedicated to outreach with these various local governments and school districts. And so there's ongoing communication with many of the local governments about access to our agreements today.
Okay, good. Thanks. That's what I was wondering, if there was a formal
yep, there is.
Process. It sounds like there is.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
I have some recommendations for the committee to adopt.
Okay, give us those recommendations.
Great. Just a bit of brief discussion here. As the committee may recall, House Bill 3099 did a whole variety of things, and we've identified the key components related to procurement in the LFO write-up. Essentially, the introduced version of House Bill 3099 complemented a full transfer of not only enterprise IT planning, policy, oversight, and operations, but also IT procurement. In the final bill, I believe we ended up with about 14 amendments to the bill. There was a split of IT procurement authority. The Department of Administrative Services retained the primary responsibility for procurement, and the DAS director continued to hold the primary authority for IT procurement. But the state CIO was given substantial new powers for oversight of procurements, so on and so forth. And again, I've included the details in the LFO write-up. What's being proposed here is, and what was shown, is a high-level conceptual model about how the two organizations would work with one another, and to essentially fulfill the end-to-end procurement process of state IT procurement. In our analysis, we did recommend, and I'll read the high-level recommendation here in a second, we did recommend temporary approval of this request for the remainder of the 2015-17 biennium, and we've asked the department and the Office of the State CIO to come back to the December legislative days with an assessment across the nation of how other states handle state IT procurement. While the predominant model is that the central state procurement office is the primary responsible party in most states, there is a trend for either a hybrid relationship like the one that the state CIO and DAS are proposing here, or a full transfer. There are about 10 to 12 states that have moved in that direction, and so we think it's valuable for the state CIO and DAS to come back in December, just before the 2017 legislative session, to make some more permanent recommendations based on more information. So with that said, as more fully described in the detailed recommendations made within the memo posted on OLIS, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the JLCIMT adopt LFO's general and specific recommendations for conditional temporary approval of the request for the remainder of the 2015-17 biennium, assuming the funding, spending authority, and personnel resources that have been requested are made available to the Department of Administrative Services and the Office of the State CIO by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Do we have, yes, Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair, I am extremely pleased with the report. On the last page of the report, there are two bullets I would like to call out because they're why I am so pleased to make the motion I'm about to make. It acknowledges that the ad hoc and uncoordinated IT procurements fragment the business of the state, creating duplication and putting the state at risk.
Yes.
And then it goes on to say something that we are poised to get for our efforts more than we would have expected and be helping partner agencies, which is local governments and school districts. We can help them just leveraging and building off the work we're already doing with little additional effort, be able to provide real substantive help to so many others. It says, new capacity will enable the development of an IT catalog of shared services, leveraging purchasing power of the state for the benefit of state agencies, partner jurisdictions, and school districts. To that end, Mr. Chair, I am very pleased to move that we adopt LFO's recommendations.
Thank you. Discussion? Objections? We adopt the LFO recommendation.
Thank you,
and
Chair.
Let me close this work session, and the next three would be for a different staff. So if we can make that switch, we'll move on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Riley. Just wanted to mention we will now transmit the JLCIMT adopted recommendations to the General Government Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. We'll do that post haste.
Great.
So we'll go ahead and transition.
Thank you. So I'm going to open a work session on the DHS Non-Magi Integrated Eligibility Project. Thank you for joining us.
Coach O'Reilly, Coach Aaron Nathanson. For the record, my name is Bob Cummings. I would like to apologize for the cough drop that I am speaking with, but I've been fighting this cough for about 10 days, and if it stays much longer, I'm going to claim it on my 2016 taxes. So this morning we have, this afternoon we have our first agenda item is the DHS Integrated Eligibility Determination Project. As described in the LFO analysis and recommendations memo posted on OLIS, the Department of Human Services has submitted a request to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for funding of the DHS Integrated Eligibility Determination Project. The purpose of this request is to provide the implementation resources needed to transfer Kentucky's Human Services Eligibility Determination functionality to Oregon, where it will be integrated with the recently deployed Oregon Health Authority's One Oregon Eligibility System, the One System, which is also based on software transferred from Kentucky. If the requested funding and personnel resources are made available by the Oregon legislature and federal funding partners, DHS estimates that the project will take 33 months to execute, with completion estimated by the end of 2018. The agency is here today to briefly explain their request. Would you please introduce yourselves for the record?
Thank you, Bob. Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Interim Director for the Department of Human Services.
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I am the COO for Technology for Oregon's Department of Human Services.
So I just want to make a few opening comments, and then I'll turn it over to Sarah. So we're here today as a follow-up to the presentation we made to you in January about the DHS Integrated Eligibility Project, and just wanted to touch on a couple points on why it's an important project for the department and why we're coming forward today with our requests. First of all, the project will increase efficiency for our staff, but I think even more importantly, it'll create an environment in which a person who is coming to apply for services will be able to submit one application with all the standard information and not be faced with what we have today in the environment in which we have today, in which they have to provide the same information and submit multiple applications for different services. The new project will allow us to have clients fill out one application, and then we will use that information to determine their eligibility for our non-Magi Medicaid programs, our SNAP or food stamp programs, our cash assistance programs, and our employee-related daycare programs. We also have a sense of urgency because we have an opportunity, which will end at the end of 2018, to leverage federal funding to help us with the project. When you look at all the different federal partners we have and average out the participation rates, we will get to approximately about a 85-15 split, 85% federal funds and 15% general fund or bond funds to help finance the project. I think the other part of the equation that reduces the risk of the project is we are building the system on an already existing implementing system, the One System, as Mr. Cummings mentioned, which is in production and which has been operational since December and is functioning quite well. And then the last point I'd like to make is that we do run the risk, because in many of these programs, the application systems that we employ are either nearing end of life or past end of life. And anytime you get into that situation, there's always a danger that the systems will start to fail and we won't have any recourse in replacing them at that point in time. So with that, I'll stop and I'll turn it over to Sarah.
Co-Chair Riley, I had the opportunity to speak with you last Friday after this hearing, and certainly I understand this is a policy conversation, not a detailed budget conversation. So I'm going to show you a quick slide because it's in our letter, but we'll spend the rest of the time talking about why this is an important investment for you all to make. So this slide captures the request on behalf of the department for the 2015-2017 biennia. In big picture, we're asking for federal fund limitation in order to be able to cover expenditures that the federal funds will pay for. We're asking for bond proceeds to support the state match portion, and we're asking for some limited duration positions, which will supplement the reallocation of previously funded permanent positions, which the body gave the department in prior sessions in order to do this work. Director Psyche took most of my talking points here, but here's a picture, right, that shows everything he just said. The beauty, in addition to the Department of Human Services being able to use a single family application for multiple DHS programs, is using the one eligibility system as the foundation allows us to also take advantage of the fact that the Oregon Health Authority can determine Medicaid eligibility in the same system. So for the first time, if this project was to be implemented, an Oregon family could present information about themselves and members of their household. Both agencies could do the work that you've asked them to do and could use a system that would automate that work to the greatest extent possible, protecting our precious caseworker time to be able to deal with the work that is most complicated in order to support coordination of care. And, you know, certainly you all know, because it's been a high priority of this body for the last several biennia, that it's important to take care of a person's health, not just from a medical perspective, but all of the surrounding social services. And so this project really helps us do that in a meaningful way in coordination of care for Oregonians. This slide we went over when we were here a few weeks ago, so I'm just going to mention it for the purposes of the record. Two big dates that matter. You heard Director Psyche talk about that the policy waiver that allows us to take advantage of additional federal funds expires in December of 2018. This project, at a reasonable pace, not a crazy Sarah Miller speed pace, but at a reasonable pace, has to start in April of this year in order to get it implemented by the time that money expires. And so that's why we're here in front of you asking for your support. This picture sort of describes what Director Psyche was talking about relative to the financial differences. So all of the programs have federal funding agencies. Each federal funding agency uses a different percentage of federal fund support for eligibility systems. CMS, which is the federal agency for Medicaid, has made the decision that in support of integrated eligibility, 90-10 Medicaid money can be used for benefit of other federal programs, specifically SNAP, TANF programs. And so that provides an opportunity to really minimize the amount of state general fund that would be necessary to accomplish the objective of coordinated care and integrated eligibility decision making. And so the scales are really different. If we do integrated eligibility all together now, the feds are going to pay way more than if we do first non-MAGI Medicaid, which is the project the department originally brought to this body, and then subsequently SNAP and TANF. The state general fund necessary to support that entire set of functionality, if we do it in order, is much greater. And so then the criteria below just sort of show you a summary of the approaches, right? So if we do it integrated, we basically get the benefit of 75 cents on every dollar for doing it together. If we do it Part A, Part B, Part C, it's going to cost $40 or $60 million more in total cost. Duration is really different, right? We can do it together in about a 33-month period. If we do it, you know, Medicaid and then the other programs, it could be 48 to 80 months, depending on how you grouped subsequent programs. There's real meaningful difference to our caseworkers in the field. When I originally came to the department, I was a supporter of doing the Medicaid-only effort until I went and did field observation in some of our offices, and I watched our DHS workers, who currently right now have to use four systems to process this set of eligibility. And if we only do non-MAGI Medicaid, we add a fifth system. And so if we do it all together, we get more rapidly to a place where our caseworkers have to do less data entry. If we do it Medicaid first and then subsequent, we introduce a fifth system that workers would have to use to service Oregonians. You heard Director Psyche talk about the fragile nature of our legacy systems. It is not without yeoman effort of some very dedicated OIS employees that we keep these systems up and available for use by caseworkers to service Oregonians. But if we do it together, we get to sunset some or partially sunset more of those systems more quickly, reducing the department's overall operational risk. And then let's talk about implementation. You heard Director Psyche say that from a technology perspective, frankly, it's the same either way. We have an existing system in production that we delivered here in Oregon, and so there's no meaningful technology difference to do them together or to do them separately. But from a business process perspective, from an opportunity to appropriately, efficiently, and effectively make determinations and service Oregonians, it's much higher risk to enter into a situation where we have to use five systems to do that work before we can sunset them. And so, you know, it's certainly the department's position and the reason why we're here with this ask, that integrated eligibility, leveraging the one infrastructure, using the same system integrator who delivered one successfully, using the same project executive who delivered one successfully, is the right answer on behalf of Oregonians. We spent some time talking about this slide when I was in front of you a few weeks ago, so I just want to point out the key dates at the bottom. If you authorize us in this session to proceed, we will begin the fit gap process. So we've selected the Kentucky system. We will spend about 4 months evaluating the functionality of the Kentucky system against Oregon's needs. If they match, it's a fit. No change is necessary. If they don't match, we call that a gap. And then there are lots of ways to resolve gaps. We can make policy changes. We can make process changes. We can make operational procedure changes. Sort of fourth, lowest on the list for me, is we can make technology changes. And the way you implement a successful transfer system is you minimize the number of times that you touch a working system and potentially break it. And so we will spend a lot of time together with very detailed analysis with people at DHS who actually do this work, not just with central office program people representing operational interest, to identify what changes need to be made. And then we'll go through an iterative development process. This is the exact process we used on the Magi Medicaid System Transfer Project to deliver the one system successfully. We'll design changes both from a technology and a business process perspective. We will build those changes both from a technology and business process perspective. And then testing is where we bring those things together, right? And we make sure that the changes we're going to make to the technology match up with the business process work that we've done. Our federal partners will require a 2-month pilot in order to be able to certify the system for go-live readiness. And then we believe the right answer is a 4-month phased rollout of the system across the state. We would expect to have that rollout complete on your behalf by December of 2018, if you give us permission to go now. Certainly, I know that Mr. Cummings and the folks that we work with in the Office of the State CIO had lots of questions about how governance would work, because there are two agencies who would want to use a single technology system. And so Kristen Deuce, the OIS CIO for both agencies, and I have been working on a governance proposal for both agency heads. I think joint governance for an enterprise system will include prioritization of both sides' work to make sure that it gets handled appropriately and both agencies get business benefit from the investment. That'll be the body that really sets the strategic life cycle. So we've been having conversations with Mr. Cummings and Mr. Erebus in the state CIO's office about what does the total life cycle of this look like if we make this investment? How long can we expect to operate it? I know Senator Hayward was asking me questions when I was here in committee a few weeks ago about, are we going to continue to make investment in the totality? And this would be the body that would do that. And then probably most importantly, it's management of state commitments to the vendor. And so OHA has taken a partnership action on behalf of DHS and have granted me, actually in my position as DHS COO for technology, contract administration responsibility for the system integration contract that supports one and OHA's implementation of one from a maintenance and operations perspective. We actually had lots of conversations with State CIO Dr. Pettit relative to not doing some of the things and that he was suggesting in the previous section, but taking advantage of the good performance of a vendor who is uniquely qualified to do this work and leveraging that experience for the benefit of DHS. And so the department has decided that I will act as the project director, the single state executive who has responsibility both for the DHS implementation and for continued vendor management of Deloitte's performance from a maintenance and operations perspective. So they like that a lot because they have one voice who will have responsibility for blending the business needs. So with that, Director Psyche and I are open for any questions you might have.
So on the last project that we saw, Representative Nathanson said why she liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you why I like this a lot. If you may or may not know that Senator Thatcher and I in 2007 led the effort to get all licensing and permitting online or one stop, and that has been pretty successful, and it's being rolled out to the agencies around the state at this time, and this would do a similar thing with your clients, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing, and also, of course, we like having less of our state money in it. So I think that's great. Any questions for these, Representative Nathanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about a statement on slide 5. If you can go back to that one. It's on the topic of risk.
Mm-hmm.
Big projects are scary.
Mm-hmm.
I am fairly intrigued, though, by the analysis that even though this seems big and you're going to integrate various things, I'm very pleased also. I've spoken about that ad nauseum. I
yes.
won't tell you all the reasons.
Super happy. I take that opinion.
Yes, super happy. It's becoming even more clear through your presentations. What I'm understanding, I think, is that there's really a higher risk to leaving these old inferior systems in place for even longer. Not only are they costing us time and resources, time that we could have been spending with clients or doing something better, but that even just using that old technology is a problem. So seriously, you evaluate, there's a risk to that too, and then you have to weigh the two. Mm-hmm.
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, certainly we have actually done a pretty detailed risk analysis, and I think two things for us. If the department was here and one eligibility system wasn't already up, the technology risk would be gargantuan. But the fact that that system is here, it's in operation, the actual technology that we will do in the integrated eligibility system, there are like two new pieces of software in total that would be introduced. So from a technology risk perspective, the new work is actually very low. I think the benefit of taking a comprehensive view of the business work the other side of the operations consideration, when you balance, yes, it's hard work, and it's why I can't tell you it can be done in less than 33 months, right? That's a long time in an IT system project in reality, but that's the right speed in which to ensure we get the business nuances right up front. We have opportunity to comprehensively test it, so that schedule will allow us to start testing in January of 2017 for what will eventually be implemented in December. So more than 18 months of testing. When you put all that together, it is totally a manageable risk. It is not without risk, right? Certainly there could be pieces and parts. Anybody who would sit here and tell you that it's a slam dunk, easy deal would be misrepresenting the truth to you. But I think the things that we find are most important in successful delivery, strong, clear executive support, clear decision making, a qualified vendor, appropriate vendor management, commitment on behalf of program executives in the department to make business change instead of technology change. The things we learned out of previous failures, frankly, on behalf of department IT initiatives are foundational to this effort. And so I believe 1,000% of my soul that the right answer for the agency and the right answer for Oregonians, it's much less risk to do it together than to do it in a phased, long-term approach. And when you add the financial benefit on top, it seems like a self-evident conclusion to me.
So, Coach Riley and Coach Nathanson, something you mentioned, which I think I don't want to be lost in this discussion, is it's really an opportunity for us to get our case managers back to doing case right. management. And that's why they came to work for us. That's what they're passionate about. Over time, the administrative burden has increased because of the multiple systems. And this is really an opportunity for us to really shore up the case management and really get people back to self-sufficiency.
Representative Nerman.
Thank you, Chair Riley. So just funny that my question was almost exactly the same as Representative Nathanson's question. And so I'll just kind of ask it again.
Sure.
And you can even just treat it as a comment because I expect your answer is going to be almost exactly what you said there. But to me, it looked odd that your risk on both of those was low risk for technology. And so effectively you're saying that phased development doesn't do you any good. And that's counterintuitive to say, you want to do everything, here's eight things, do them all at once, mm-hmm. what's the risk for that?
Yeah.
Or you can do them one at a time,
right.
whatever. And I'll even stack the deck for you a little bit. I'll say that I almost see that when you do them all at the in a row like that, that you almost introduce some risk. Some of it you talked about,
yeah.
but just there's other things that over time, the technology changes
sure.
quickly.
Sure.
You have just the lifespan of developers,
right.
you know, staying on the project is
right.
low and all that. So I'll just stick that out as a comment, and you can comment back at me if you'd like.
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Nierman, certainly I'm in agreement with all of your comments. I think the piece that maybe is most interesting to me is I told you when I was in front of you guys before that we were like the kids who failed chemistry cheating off the valedictorians by taking Kentucky. And we talked about that there was a change in governorship and the project is very different in Kentucky now. The human service portion of that system under new leadership, they put on hold when it was supposed to go live in December. And actually, after 2 months of analysis, the governor's office reached out to us and said, it makes so much sense for service delivery and the approach to making sure that we're running efficient and effective government, which really matters in that particular agenda, that they actually are supporting what would be sort of counterintuitive in that way, right? An expansion of an eligibility system for human service programs. And so I think it's sort of interesting because I think what everybody wants is how do we do the work most efficiently? And you know, I think when you balance all things in totality, this will take great effort for 33 months, but the benefit it will pay back in making sure we're spending the time doing the right work and making sure we're servicing Oregonians in a way that you all can believe in, right? It will increase our program integrity. It will decrease the amount of fraud and abuse that we have because we'll have a centralized system where we can do lots more robust analysis. I think it's uniquely interesting to be in a situation where both sides, I think, benefit from an approach that best services Oregonians.
Fortunately, in this state, both sides like all of those things. We like taking care of
yes.
people,
right.
and
right.
we like efficient government.
Right.
And I think that we're lucky in this state in that way. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt LFO's recommendations.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson moves the adoption of the LFO recommendations. Any discussion? Any objections? They are adopted. And I'm closing the work session on the non-Magi Integrated Eligibility Project. And we're going to, this one? We're going to open a work session on the DAS Human Resource Information System Project.
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, The next item on the agenda is the DAS Human Resources System Project, and as described in the LFL analysis and recommendation memo posted on OLIS, the Oregon Department of Administrative Services submitted a budget request to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for the planning resources. DAS needs to complete the detailed planning that is required to demonstrate agency readiness to proceed with the execution phase of the DAS Human Resources HRIS project. The agency is here today to briefly explain their request. Would you please introduce yourselves for the record?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the State of Oregon. I'm also the Acting DAS Director and Acting Chief Operating Officer. To my left is Dr. Pettit, who you well know as the Chief Information Officer of the state. And to my right is Madeline Zeik, who's the Chief Human Resource Officer. With that, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'm going to briefly kick us off. For those who have been watching this, the state of Oregon has a series of systems that really manage our administrative functions. They fall into four major categories: accounting, budgeting, human resources, and payroll, and a series of other systems that go related to that. All of those systems are between 10 and 30 years old. So we have embarked over the last several years working very closely with Dr. Cummings to come with a plan for the most critical of those systems, which is our human resource system, which we are here today to talk to you about. The first part of this presentation will be Dr. Pettit giving you the context for where the HR system fits in the rest of those, and then Ms. Zeik will be walking you through the specifics of the HR system. What I will say right off the bat is that from an enterprise perspective, the HR system is the one that's at most critical need of actually addressing right now. It's something that does not provide the information that our boss, the governor, nor you as legislators provides that you need to make decisions, and that's why we're here in front of you today. I will emphasize that we are not here to ask for a go-live on the project yet. As Dr. Cummings said, we are here to get your endorsement in front of the Ways and Means Committee next week, General Government, to go forward with detailed planning. So we will then come back. If we're approved for the detailed planning money, we will use that to build a plan that we'll bring back to the 2017 session. And with that, Mr. Chair Riley, I'll turn over to Mr. Pettit for the background.
Chairman Riley, Chairman Nathanson, for the record, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon. So as Mr. Naughton had gone through and talked about, the state of Oregon is at a decision point regarding its existing information technology systems. The current landscape is composed of disparate, non-integrated point solutions that simply cannot provide the required functionality or data to meet the needs of stakeholders. Mr. Naughton had said, the accounting and financial system up there, SFMA, is 19 years of age. Payroll, 28 years of age. Budget is our youngster of the group, coming in at 12 years of age. And, of course, the HRIS system, which we're going to talk about today, is 23 years of age. So we have a pretty mature portfolio of systems, and unlike those of us, they don't tend to mature, improve as they mature. So,
some could say the same about us, Mr. Pettit.
I like this chart. This looks like a very busy chart. My apologies, but it does show. It groups systems into categories: human resources, payroll, benefits, reporting, and such. And the reason I like this is because it demonstrates the data transfers or the data flows between the system. If there are places where systems are fragile, it's really at those integration points, those double darts, where information gets passed from one system to another and has to be formed or reformed or transformed into another format, and any of the changes in any single system or a failure in any system, as you see, affects the entire ecosystem in one way or another. So, in the proposed future state, what Ms. Zeik and her team are working on is really to have a landscape that's less diverse, fewer interfaces to maintain, improve functionality, providing and reducing the need for agency one-off systems to fill in gaps of things that they can't get today from the centralized system. All state data available for reporting in one place, and to look at and consider the SaaS solutions that are available out there and are updated. And so another analogy, states tend to jump to new technologies, and then they sit there a long time on them until they're quite old, and then they jump forward again. One of the benefits to moving towards a software as a service process is it is an operational expense, and it's continuously updated and doesn't tend to fall behind or fall out of date. And this chart's very similar to the one that was presented to this committee a year ago. KPMG went through and did a review and refined the roadmap. HRIS is the first one there, as you see, to be followed by the payroll and time and attendance. And then lastly, the financial accounting and budgeting portfolio at the end there. And so as we move through, there's a flow to it that we're expecting as we go through this implementation process. So, and with that, I'll turn it over to Madeline Zeich, the Chief Human Resources Officer.
I recognize that.
Yeah, pretty good, isn't it?
Co-chairs Riley and Nathanson. I'm Madeline Zeich. I'm the state's Chief Human Resources Officer. And so I was thinking as I prepared for my presentation, what could I show you that would really speak to you about what we are encountering here? And so what you have before you on the screen is an actual screenshot of our PPDB system, which stands for Position and Personnel Database. As Dr. Pettit said, it's about 23 years old, and I would also agree that it probably has not gotten better with age. How this system is used to track our workforce statewide is via a form, and I'm sorry I didn't put the form up there, but we have a two-page form that people fill out to bring people into the system, exit from the system, and any personnel actions for the workforce within state government. This form is couriered around in a number of different formats. We have couriers that send it back and forth. It comes in the mail. People hand deliver it. They fax it. They scan it, those sorts of things. So to start someone as a new employee in our system, there are about 14 different codes that you have to put in, and you need to memorize those. And I've been here about 2 years, as I said, and they said, well, you need to memorize your codes. And so that was a bit of a shock for me, but that's how we do things in our system, is by codes. It's an older, as I said, COBOL system, so there are a lot of really great COBOL programmers around, but it doesn't seem to be the programming language of choice for some of the newer technology people just getting out of school. We also have some issues with this system not supporting functionality. So one of the big disappointments, I think, for all of us is when we have leadership that asks us for information and we can't provide it. And this system really doesn't allow us to provide you the kind of good statewide information that we believe you ought to have for making decisions in the workforce. Also something that I understand that is near and dear now to listening today to Representative Nathanson's heart is redundancy, accuracy, and duplication of efforts in this system. Okay, next slide. So we've been planning. This planning has gone on for, it started before I got here. I think it's been going on for about 3 years. And it began with an identification statewide through the enterprise leadership team as well as other stakeholders within the state that we really needed to do something different. And that enterprise leadership team, who is made up, it's an advisory group of 20 agency directors of small and large agencies and the deputies for elected officials, chartered this project and said this was a priority for them. Since that time, we've also had a letter of support from Governor Brown. We're very thankful for that. We've also completed a business case. There were 808 requirements and about 43 different processes that we know we need to change within HR. We've done vendor systems demonstrations. We've talked to those that are involved in best practice. We've worked very closely with LFO and Dr. Pettit and his staff. In fact, Mr. Cummings, I'd really like to thank him publicly for our weekly meetings. We've been spending time once a week working on this project. We've gotten our stage one and stage two endorsement, and we've hired KPMG as a project advisor to help with the overall strategy. can go on. Our goal is to have a modern HR system that can really improve not only employee productivity, but provide the reports that we need for decision making, reduce complexity, provide HR data that's accurate, reduce the need for agencies to come up with their own ways of tracking information so that it's all in a more centralized fashion, and eliminate some of the wonderful paper that we have moving around. And our funding request, Mr. Naughton already talked a little bit about where we're at right now. We really are asking for authorization to continue with additional planning to make sure that we are doing due diligence regarding this project, make sure we're evaluating all the risks, give us some time to do some additional business process reengineering. And so that's what we're asking for at this time. And then our hope is to return to the next legislative session with more information about what something like this might cost and updates to the Stage 3, hoping to get our Stage 3 authorization, the LFO readiness, and work with all our stakeholders to make sure that we're moving in the right direction. And so I think that was about all I had for you today. We really wanted to update you on where we're at. We're also going to general government next week. So we were hoping that we might get your support for moving forward.
Regions.
Any questions?
Representative Nierman.
So thank you, Chair Riley. So we've heard about this thing. I think this is about the third time or whatever I've heard about it. So the latest budget request then is going to cause a RFP to be issued. It seems like that's about where it's at then, right?
Yes.
When do you expect that to happen?
Co-Chair Riley, Representative Nierman, we're hoping to release an RFP sometime in the spring so that we can get good estimates for our next budget request moving forward in the next session.
Can I follow?
Sure.
So then in the spring, then are you expecting a funding request in the 2017 legislative session?
Co-Chair Riley, Representative Nierman, yes, that's what we would be doing.
Okay, good.
Representative Nathans.
Thank you. Well, then that brings up a new question for me. RFP this year, funding wouldn't be really considered, much less finalized, until a year after that. So I'm recalling a little bit of the conversation on the previous agenda item. If a lot of time elapses between when you make an arrangement with a vendor to do something and then finally you get funding to do it, are there any vendors willing to sign on with you way in advance on a sort of speculative basis? I assume that they need to be planning what they're promising different customers. You know, we can start working for you now because we're at this point in product development for this other customer. And how, well, also the issue of software evolves pretty rapidly. So it seems like there's just such a long lead up time before this. And then, very specifically, I remember from the previous discussion, project teams can change. So there's risk if there's change on either the vendor side or the client, the customer side, like our agency staff. So if there's that much time, I just don't quite understand how we deal with when the world changes so rapidly, and also we have to count on contracts and development of software projects like this. I understand why once something gets going, it might take a while to do it, but getting someone to promise and us to commit also so far in advance, it's sort of like, wow, the world has changed since we signed the dotted line and you want us to start now, you know, a year later. How does that work?
Senator Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, I think there are a few really good questions there that I think I'll try and take them one at a time and see if I remember all of your key points. We have had conversations, really great questions, because this is something that we were talking to LFO staff just about last week, and how we minimize those risks of availability of vendors, availability of key state staff, and making sure that they haven't gone off and committed those to some other project somewhere. One of the things we've done with this strategy is that we're going to bring, as far as the state staffing, we're bringing in the state staffing and staffing up the project team, and so they'll remain throughout. So there's no plan. We're asking for enough funding to carry us through at least those first several months of session so that our key project staff for the agency will be managed. We're also looking at ways to structure our RFP so that we may have some work that the vendor can do based on availability of funds that might carry them through until we can actually commit, if the funding is awarded, to additional activities. Because I think you're absolutely right that that is a risk in both areas. The third is software as a service is one of the things that we're looking at for HR, a little bit different maybe than the project we just heard about before. Yeah. One of the real risks in HR is because we have a lot of federal changes in laws. We have statutes regarding employment. We have all of those kinds of things that occur for us, and then our systems have to try and catch up and be programmed that way. Usually these systems that are an off-the-shelf system, they're being modified for all of those things along the way, so that helps us a little bit. And then we're really, one of the big risks of this project, and I think one of our major strategies is we know we have to change our business processes for HR. They've been supported by a very old system. We know things have changed. And so one of our major focuses will be working on trying to change our business processes, any rules that we have to change in preparing for a vendor. I think those are really good questions, and we need to have more conversations with the state CIO and the LFO staff and internally with our project team to talk about it. Was there anything else you wanted to add, Dr. Pettit?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so don't mean to overgeneralize it. There's really three phases or three stages that this is going to go through. First is the product selection, figuring out what it is exactly that we're going to get. There's a lot of options out there. We talk about the SaaS solutions. There's also in-house solutions. There's all kinds of different things. And then, really, the second one is as Zyke had talked about, was the gap analysis. And that gap analysis is going to inform. So if I could go back to slide, whatever it was with the green screen, there's going to be a big gap between what we are doing today and what we're proposing to do. And our expectation is a lot of that gap is going to be, a lot of that change is going to be absorbed by our people and not so much by the technology. So when you do what's called a package-enabled reengineering, we wrote a paper on this some years ago. It's the Fusion series by Ernst & Young. They talk about you can change the process, you can change the training, or you can change the application. Well, in PER, you primarily change the process. And so to do that, you really have to come through with a very clear gap analysis of what it is that we're doing today. And are those things that are required by statute or by federal law, or are they things that are things that we can adapt to and things that we have to change? And that change is going to take time, is going to need to be articulated. And once we have that, then we'll understand what kind of systems integration we're going to need to have. It's going to be systems integration, and bringing in an integrator is going to be about integrating the system, but it is more going to be about helping the organization transition
process
to a new way of doing it. So it's not a traditional kind of, when we've talked about systems integrations in the past, we're usually talking about adaptations of the software to the people. In this case, we're really going to be talking about adapting people to the software, and that's going to be an important difference, and something we need to be very respectful of and very very deliberate about as we go about doing this. And I guess I see that as being so the selecting the product and then coming to terms with the product and agreeing to the product. I think that's going to be the most minor piece to this. It'll be the gap analysis, and then that implementation process, that integration process. That's going to be more challenging. I hope that answers your question, Matt.
So two of the good things we have is a SaaS solution would mean that even though we select the vendor at this time, by the time we start to implement, they have maybe already made changes to their system based on new regulation from the federal government and from our state. And so we don't lose that that update. The other good thing is that we only have one state that we have to worry about the regulations from. I've implemented a multi-state payroll systems, and that's a whole different ball game. So we have a lot of risk already taken care of in that way. So that's a good thing. Further questions? Would you tell us your LFO recommendation, please?
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathan, the members of the committee. LFO recommendation is, as more fully described in the detailed recommendations made within the memo posted on OLIS, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the JCLMIMT adopt LFO's general and specific recommendations for approval of the planning resource request for the DAS HRS project, assuming the requested funding resources and expenditure limitation are made available to the agency by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Nathanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt LFO's recommendations as described in their memo.
Discussion? Objections? We're adopting the LFO recommendation, and I'm going to close the work session on that item. We're going to open a work session on the PERS Disaster Recovery and Business Continuity Planning Budget Note Report.
Co-Chair Riley, Representative Nason, members of the committee. As described in the LFO analysis and recommendations memo posted on OLIS, during the 2015 legislative session, the Oregon Public Employment System submitted a request to the JC Joint Committee on Ways and Means for an increase in expenditure limitation to enable PERS to upgrade agency disaster recovery infrastructure and business continuity planning capabilities. The requested limitation was approved but unscheduled, pending PERS action on a budget note that was included within the agency's budget bill, House Bill 5034. The budget note required PERS to conduct a detailed health check and risk assessment of the current state of its disaster recovery and business continuity environment, including the state of its current disaster recovery and business continuity plans. The budget note further required PERS to develop an associated prioritized action plan to correct all identified deficiencies and ensure that its disaster recovery and business continuity plans are in alignment with state policy standards and guidelines. Finally, PERS was directed to report to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means during the legislative session in 2016 with its findings and prioritized action plan. The agency is here today to briefly explain their progress towards addressing these budget note requirements. Would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Co-Chair Riley and members of the committee, my name is Steve Rodman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employee Retirement System.
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Jordan Sanga, CIO of PERS.
So the presentation we put together provides you with the overview of that budget note, and thanks to the LFO staff for reiterating it. What we have done is, since the close of the 2015 session is recognized through our organizational structure the place and home where business continuity planning and execution needs to live in our organization. As we noted in the presentation, the statewide focus on enterprise business continuity dropped in 2009, and since July 1, 2015, in our agency, business continuity resides in our newly established compliance audit and risk division. One staff person that was responsible for business continuity was transferred into that section, and we are putting together a business continuity program, and the resources around that will be, as a preview, something that we will be bringing forward in the 2017-19 session. So that's that is the organizational evolution that we've made as far as business continuity and disaster planning goes. We also recognize the need to update our current business continuity plan, which we have had since 2010, a very comprehensive plan. But of course, changes have happened since then. So we have, for example, changed our organizational structure and created a new management system and other changes that need to be incorporated into that plan. So based on that initial analysis, then we've identified some high-risk areas that need immediate attention, one of which, of course, is restoration or continued operation of our pension payments. Pension payments go out every month, and they are in excess of $300 million. And as I've said, if for whatever reason we were unable to make that $300 million payment each month, somebody would notice. So we want to make sure that there is continuity in that payment stream. The other thing that we've done is, at LFO's recommendation, increase the frequency in which we store off-site the backup tapes that we do generate. We always generated them every day. We would store them off-site a couple times a week. At LFO's recommendation, we move those off-site now every day. And as I said earlier, we've established a discrete business continuity program. So that is something that you're going to see more detail about when we come back in 17-19 for the resources associated with that program. We want to, in setting that 2017-19 budget request, we want to, of course, set the right size for that program within our agency. So we want to determine the kind of work that has to be done and where that ought to live and how many people that ought to take to do that. Our business continuity staff member that we have may not be enough to complete that work in this biennium, so our compliance audit and risk division administrator, Jason Stanley, who's with us today, is assessing where and how we can bring additional resources to bear to complete that program, that planning in time. And then, of course, ultimately, you want to update your plan, you want to test it, and you want to normalize business continuity in the agency's operations. In other words, this isn't just a one-time shot where LFO's asked us to respond to a budget note, so we respond to a budget note, and okay, that's done. We just put that on the back shelf. Business continuity and disaster recovery have to be normalized and accountable as an operation within the agency. So we want to identify where that lives. We want to build in the repetitive structure of continually updating and testing our business continuity and disaster recovery planning. So those are the steps that we're going to take in further development of our business continuity and disaster recovery efforts. Now that is, if I may say, a response to the budget note, which LFO staff has given to us. Separate from the budget note, and by separate I mean not necessarily within the scope of what the budget note has asked us to do, we did have a policy package 105. The policy package 105 was to bolster the technology infrastructure behind our business continuity and disaster recovery planning. So, mindful, co-chair, that this is not a budget committee. I don't want to go through the detail of that policy package request at this time. That will be going, of course, as LFO staff said, that money has been appropriated. We need to work with LFO staff, OSCIO staff, and others to have the funds rescheduled and put into our budget. What I will say, though, is that we do not have a consistent approach from all of those decision makers as to what the expectations are before those funds will be rescheduled. And so we want to continue those conversations. I think LFO's recommendations in this matter show some of those different expectations. And that impetus behind the LFO staff's recommendation is taking a broader look at our overall agency's readiness assessment for business continuity and disaster recovery planning. The specific request we made in 105 was for a piece of that. So we need to work out how much of the greater do you have to do to get the former involved. I keep working on trying to come up with an analogy. It's like we're remodeling the kitchen, and the budget note is asking us to talk about all of the detail for that kitchen remodel, as far as down to architectural details and selecting all the bits and pieces before we're even starting to think about shopping for a stove and a refrigerator. Well, you still need some basic pieces of that, and sometimes knowing what those basic pieces are going to be will help you design the overall plan. So we're in kind of a cat and mouse or a catch-22 as far as that goes. Those are conversations we've started and, of course, engaged in with LFO staff, and we'll continue to do so through the process to get those funds rescheduled and freed up so we can move forward with the technology infrastructure components.
Thank you. This is a really serious issue about the disaster recovery and business continuity. I'm reminded of a place where I worked where they backed up the data to a disk and stored it in a different room in the building. And in addition, only the data processing, the actual operators in the computer room knew that the disk wasn't big enough, so they only had 3/4 of the data stored. So we have to really be careful about, you know, talking about, yes, we're going to do it, but are the details really there? So, any questions? Would you give us your recommendation?
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I'd like to briefly expand a little more than we normally do on our recommendation. The agency came forward in 2015 and asked for disaster recovery and BCP funds, and there was obviously a need there, but it wasn't clear. It was mixed, and it wasn't clear to the LFO exactly what the state of their processes were, their plans, et cetera. And so we recommended a budget note that had 10 to 12 things for them to do, including a detailed analysis of where they were at, what they had, because they had things mixed into their pot package that could have been system enhancements as much as disaster recovery. This past year, they have done quite a bit of work on that, but not sufficient to make the LFO feel comfortable that the requirements of that budget note were met. During the interim, we also talked with the state CIO, and they reminded us that PERS had committed to doing an analysis of why they have a data center four or five years ago when RIMS project was done, and that had not been done, and they questioned why we would be looking at disaster and business continuity functions there first when we maybe should be looking at whether they should be transferred to the state data center where they could pick up those services automatically there. We thought that made good sense. I talked with the Office of State CIO, and the recommendations that the LFO made basically were say, let's finish that commitment there first, then see what the needs are, and go forward from there. So your LFO recommendation is basically that, and it's more fully described in detail in the memo posted on OLIS. And the LFO recommends that the committee adopt LFO's general and specific recommendations for this request. It basically asks, so you know, that PERS work closely with OSCIO to assess their need for a data center and their need for disaster recovery business continuity planning in that context.
Discussion. Representative Nearman.
So this question is for Mr. Cummings. Is it on the table that PERS will no longer have their own data center? Is that what I'm hearing? That's one of the options?
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Nearman. It's my understanding, and I was not directly involved with the discussions when the RIMS project, J. Clarity, was put into place. One of the commitments that the previous management of PERS made was that they would do a detailed analysis of whether they had the need for their own individual data center. That has never been completed, and that was the state CIO was reminded of that and felt that that was a good idea, and the LFO concurred that commitment needed to be dealt with one way or the other.
So the answer is yes, that
yes.
Is on the table.
Yes.
If I could, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Steinhaber.
Thank you. Representative Nearman, I appreciate your concern. I have the privilege of serving as co-chair of the General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it was our subcommittee that worked with the PERS team on this in the 2015 session. and exactly how, what the final outcome of where the offsite recovery is stored is, frankly, to some extent irrelevant. What's important is that there be a very efficient 21st century offsite data storage and recovery option, which currently really isn't at the level that we need. If something goes down, we've got, Mr. Redman, help me out here, how many beneficiaries getting checks from us every month?
Right, 130,000.
130,000 beneficiaries getting checks from us every month, and that number changes, that grouping changes every single week. And we need to be sure that we have those data backed up consistently in a place where they can be stored safely, where if something goes sideways with the system here, that the offsite location is in, done in such a way that it's unlikely to be affected by the same, whatever it was that caused the onsite failure. So that's, I think a lot of the details, you know, we're still working on exactly what it's going to look like, but the bottom line is what's going on now, nobody thinks is anywhere close to sufficient or in keeping with current standards for backup. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Redman?
It is, Co-Chair Riley, Senator Steiner here, if I may. We entered into Package 105 with the concept of these are tools we need to facilitate disaster recovery and business continuity, regardless of what the plan solution is. So, for example, we have a box downstairs. We have a lot of boxes, but we have a box downstairs. If the box downstairs isn't available, where's the other box? You know, is the other box in the state data center? Is the other box in the retirement systems of Montana, who we have a reciprocal agreement with or something? I'm not saying we do. I'm just saying, hypothetically, where is it? So that's what a piece of 105 was, is where is the other box going to be? Then in a couple of the pieces of the request were, here are other technology components that would make accessing that box remotely good. Single sign-on and virtual desktop, allow our staff to work in a distributed model instead of our current model. What LFO has brought into this recommendation is a different question, and I think in fairness to Mr. Cummings and to us, as he said, this was on a commitment by a prior administration. Whatever the transition from Mr. Cleary to me included, it did not include, oh, by the way, here's a report you need to give to LFO about the state data center. So this was news to us. We're happy to do that analysis and happy to come back at any opportunity to talk about this, the relative merits of having an independent data center versus one in the state data center. As I read, or as I understand the recommendation, it isn't just where we put the next box. It's where do we live?
That's right. Where you put and, that box that's in the basement.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that is an entirely system. Different
Sorry
question.
Sorry if I wasn't clear about that.
So the production system, that's what we're talking
Correct.
About.
Yeah. So that's an entirely different question. Again, one we're happy to assess and answer, clean that up or tighten up that requirement. But again, it doesn't relate specifically to the technology components that we have in 105.
So, as I understand the recommendation, it's to do the assessment about where you put the production system before we go on to this thing that you're asking for now. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, the recommendation has both features in it. It identifies, and the reason it identified the data center was because of the cost savings that could be realized not only for the production system, but for utilizing the backup and recovery disaster planning services that are already at the state data center. But by doing the assessment of where the data center resides first, follow it up by an assessment of the disaster planning that could be automatically picked up by the state data center if they were to move, we cover both areas. The only thing that isn't covered, and I believe that Representative Steiner brought up, and that is that we have to make sure that during the interim that we have sufficient backup and recovery and disaster protection, that we don't that we're not adding additional risk while we get this work done.
So, do we have a motion?
I'm happy to move LFO recommendation.
Okay. Representative Nathan has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there further discussion? Is there opposition? The LFO recommendation is adopted, and I'm closing the work session. Is there any further business that we need to conduct in this this meeting?
Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, our work for today is complete.
So the committee is adjourned.
I'm going to be up to my office.
Yes. I will be there.
Okay.
Be there.
Okay.